you know, it doesn't take that many hours to be a good writer. I mean, if you write a page an hour and you write 3 hours a day, which is very little, that's still 20 pages a week, which is about 1,000 pages a year. 1,000 pages is a lot. So even if only a quarter of them aren't good, that's still a good book a year, you know, and that's at 3 hours a day. So if you can stomach, you know, 6 hours a day, then man, I mean, that's like Stephen King levels.
What's going on, guys? I'm excited about this one. If you want to be a writer, you know, if you want to write comedy, I think you'll be able to pull a lot of wisdom out of this one. This is one of my favorite conversations that we've had because there's a bit of an interesting story behind it. Now, let me walk you through that really quick. A couple years back, Zach and I are in college. We're in film school. Now, if you've ever been on a student film set before, 9 times out of 10, it's complete hell. And this one was not great. So the guy who was supposed to be doing a lot of the organizational work and a lot of the heavy lifting, keeping everybody on track, he just sits down in the middle of filming, whips out his laptop, and just completely checks out. So we walk up to him and we're like, what's going on? And he flips his laptop around and he's watching a TV show. And Zach and I are just hooked immediately. Like, the show is incredibly witty. It's got this like kind of surreal humor to it. And it's just so, so good. And we're like, what is this? And he's like, it's Man Seeking Woman. It was a complete revelation to us. Like, we'd never seen anything like it before. So Zach and I just binged the rest of the season. And so anyways, that film finished, done. A couple months later, we moved to Toronto and Zach and I start working on sets. And then eventually the guys that we're working with are like, yo, we're doing the next season of Man Seeking Woman. Do you want to come out on set with us? And we're just like, really? Like, definitely. Like, that's a dream come true. Like, yeah, of course. So we go out on set, and it is, like, it's everything that we hoped it would be and more. The crew is just, like, barely keeping it together during every single take, like, because it's just so witty, and, like, everyone's cracking up, and it's just that we're having the time of our life. And then after a while, we start to notice that we're seeing this guy walking around set all the time, and he's, you know, a little bit of a smaller dude. He looks pretty young. He's got this confidence about him. He's walking around with his flip phone. He's got these wicked suspenders. We're like, who is this guy? So we do a bit of research and we're like, oh, that's Simon Rich. That's the guy who created the whole show. Like, that's the showrunner. He wrote the book that this series is based on. So we look up a bit more of his work and we're just in awe. Like, this guy wrote for SNL for a number of years. He went and wrote for Pixar. If you've seen Inside Out, like, it has his fingerprints all over it. And he went to Harvard. Like, he was the president of the Harvard Lampoon. Like, this guy has just, he's a complete comedic force of nature. So later on at the wrap party, Zach and I are about to leave. We turn around and then there he is. There's Simon Rich. And so we're like, Simon, dude, this show is incredible. Like, we looked up a ton of your other work and, like, dude, you're just killing it. And he's very humble. He's very gracious and thankful to your kind words. So anyways, flash forward a couple months, Zach and I are just sitting there reflecting on that moment. And we're like, man, how great would it be to have a conversation with Simon and just, you know, learn a little bit about his process and his career, kind of how he got to where he is, and, you know, just get a little bit of wisdom from him. So we're like, let's do it. Why not? So we reach out to him. We're like, hey, Simon, you might not remember us. Yeah, you know, we talked at the rap party. Anyways, we've got this radio show. Would you like to come on and do an interview? And we totally didn't expect to hear back, but we did. The next day he gets back to us and he's like, definitely, like, here, I've got time next week. Let's lock into the calendar. So Zach and I are looking at that email and we look at each other and we're like, holy shit. Now we like, first of all, we didn't have a radio show. We didn't have a podcast. And we're like, holy shit. Now we have to make a podcast so that we don't look like assholes in front of Simon Rich. So we did. We you know, got some microphones together. We figured out everything from a technological standpoint, you know, finished up our research. And then 2 weeks later, we dial into the interview. So this was our first ever interview. And you can tell. Zach and I asked some questions that we can tell immediately. Like, oh, Simon just like tried to dodge it because, you know, it's, we didn't really think through like, oh, yeah, that's, he's not allowed to talk about that. Let's not ask him. So anyways, Simon, if you're listening to this, I apologize for it taking so long to hit the airwaves, but here it is. And, you know, for all of you guys listening at home, if you want to be a writer, you know, if you want to write comedy, I think you'll be able to pull a lot of wisdom out of this one. So without any further ado, here he is, Simon Rich. Hope you guys enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, we are about to go live with Simon Rich. Here this we go. Is going to be fun.
Hey there.
Hey, Simon. Welcome to the show. It's so nice to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Simon, before we get started here, just going over some of your existing interviews, we noticed a pattern. At what point did the age jokes start getting old?
Oh, I welcome them more and more as I progress into my 30s. You know, I have a couple of gray hairs now, so I start to crave the jokes. But this is a podcast, right? So nobody knows what I look like. I'm extremely, extremely young looking. I know that seems would come as a surprise listening to my sonorous baritone voice, but I'm a small, young looking guy, so I get dig about that a lot.
Well, it's funny because our follow up question was actually, at what point do you start getting old? But you just answered right there.
No, it's happening.
Are you still on the East Coast? Or are you on the West Coast?
I'm in LA these days, and we're doing post on a season 3 of my TV show, Man Seeking Woman.
Well, you guys are still in post. I know that's airing right now.
Yeah. We are still working on the last couple of episodes. It's pretty late in the process, so at this point, it's like mostly VFX and sound mixing, things like that.
It's amazing how many things seem to have come full circle for you. I mean, growing up, some of your biggest influences were SNL, The Simpsons, and Roald Dahl. And now you've written for SNL. You've got Ian from The Simpsons working with you on your own show. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read somewhere that you're involved in a Willy Wonka project.
Yeah, no, it's been a very exciting few years, and it's always been my dream as a kid to just try to imitate my heroes and rip them off as much as possible, and now I feel like I get to do that for a living, so it's very exciting.
What kind of pressure is that? If you are, in fact, working on the Willy Wonka, I know you said that before you would actually just try to plagiarize Roald Dahl and pass it off as your own, and now you're actually getting paid to make a whole new story based off that character. Is there like an extra pressure getting that right?
It's as a writer, you have to just, no matter what you're working on, you have to just kind of write stuff that you love and not think too hard about it, you know, especially about how it's going to be received. My experience, the more pressure you put on something to succeed, the worse it is. If you're not having fun writing it, then odds are people aren't going to have fun reading it or watching it.
Is there anything else in the pipeline now? I know Unicorn Executions and Sellout, those were kind of, I'm not sure, are those still in development?
Those are both, as a screenwriter, it's very hard to be the guy to talk about where things are at development-wise because you don't really hold a lot of the cards. But the thing I'm working on right now, when you called, was another book of short stories. And that's my focus at the moment, my main focus.
So you're saying there's a new book of short stories coming out that you're working on?
Yeah, more stories, and that's always been my favorite thing to do is just write short stories, and that's what I started out doing, and hopefully what I'll keep doing for as long as I'm writing.
That's awesome. Right.
Actually, yeah, going back to sort of early on in your career, I mean, obviously for a young comedy writer, SNL is like the dream. How did you manage to catch their eye?
They hired me based on my first book, which I wrote in college, which was book of short stories called Anthem. They hired me as a writer. SNL has a long history of hiring writers who don't really have a lot of television experience. They tend to hire writers who are coming off successful stand-up careers. They hire writers from places like websites like Love Average or College Humor or The Onion, and hire writers from, you know, sketch shows like Chicago Second City. They hire UCB performers. And so though I didn't have any television writing experience, I wasn't eccentric. Because nobody was a typical TV writer in my group. I remember my two main writing partners were John Mulaney, so he had a little bit of TV experience, but not much. And then Marika Sawyer, she had come up as a SNL receptionist, writing jokes for Weekend Update on the side. So it was an interesting group of writers, and everyone brought something different to the table. And I had a really great time, and I learned a lot from everybody.
Right. That must have been really intimidating when you first started to meet those people. Like, what was the interview process like?
The interview process was pretty brief. I mean, you know, Colin Jost has been a writer for a couple of years. He was president of the Harvard Lampoon a couple of years before I was. He knew me and knew my writing, and he passed my book along to, or maybe just a couple issues of the New Yorker I had written for, to Seth Meyers, who was one of the head writers at the time. And I went in and met Seth and Steve Higgins and Mike Shoemaker, who were producers at the producers over there. It was very brief, and then I met Lauren. But Lauren really trusts his producers, and he really, really trusted Seth. The fact that everybody vouched for me was enough. I think he interviews everybody, but it's more of a formality. I think usually by the time he interviews somebody, he's already made up his mind, mostly based on their writing and their performance if they're to be in the cast. I mean, people, there's stories that people have blown the interview with Lauren, but I'm not positive that that's always true. I think that Lauren is just trying to make SNL as great as possible, and if he believes in a writer or an actor, he's going to try to fix his damnedest to figure out a way to get them into the show.
Actually, even about that topic of trust, you said that he gave you a whole lot of trust when you went forward to make Man Seeking Woman into a TV show.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I don't think the show would have happened without his help and support. He gives every project comedic legitimacy just by vouching for it. So when you're pitching a show as unusual as Man Seeking Woman, it really helps to have a comedy legend like Lauren. It means the world to me that he was willing to do that. And he's also just been a huge help creatively as a producer on the show, with who ought to direct the show, who ought to be in it, huge decisions. We lean on him for his advice, and we're super lucky to have him on board.
Now, how did you make the jump from SNL to Pixar? How was that bridge built?
I don't know specifically what it was that got me hired over there. I know they had read my first novel, because we talked about that in the interview. It was around my fourth year at SNL. I had also started doing some screenplay work, just rewriting people's scripts and writing some original scripts for different movie studios. So yeah, by then I had a little bit more of a, I had more stuff to show, and the pieces for the new year, which I kept on writing when I was at SNL.
Right, and by your first novel, you're talking about Elliot Allagash?
Yes.
Awesome. Now, those two places are like, they're at the apex of their respective categories. Was it a tough decision to leave one for the other, or was it more of like an easy transition?
It was a little scary to move to California. I'd visited California a few times. I was like 26, and I remember being like anxious about it, but I also felt that I had done everything at SNL that I felt like I was capable of doing. And I remember talking to Lauren about it, because he had to let me out of my contract, because I don't know what it is today, but when I started at SNL, I signed a 5-year deal, which at the time was standard for every writer. It might still be that way, I'm not sure. I think the cast maybe is locked up for more than 5 years. Actually, I think maybe for them it's 7. I don't know if any of this is true, so don't hold me to it. But yeah, I had to get Lauren's permission to go. So I had to call him, excited for me and excited that I had this opportunity to try something new. And so he very generously said, yeah, that's the kind of guy is. I mean, if you like need a letter to give like a landlord as a reference to like buy an apartment or something, like Lauren will like write you the letter. Seriously, like if you need help with anything, you need a good doctor, because like you have some medical thing going on, like he will help you find one. Like he has just helped thousands of people and gone above and beyond to do it.
You mentioned earlier how you'd written a couple novels. So you've written for the screen, you've written for TV, numerous short stories, and then the novels. And I think I read a couple weeks ago that you actually wrote a novel just before heading off to Harvard. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, my very, very first try at a novel.
Very, very first novel, yeah.
Yeah, I was, I first tried a novel, the first novel that I actually finished a draft of was the summer after my senior year of high school. And I don't remember much about it, but I think I had really found my voice yet as a writer, as they say. It was, it was proved to myself that I actually could physically write a novel. And then the next year or the year after, I wrote a collection of short stories, which I also failed to sell. But at least I started submitting the stories. So I didn't show the novel to anybody other than a couple of friends. I knew it wasn't very good. But the stories, my first book of stories, I actually did send out to magazines, and they all got rejected. But that felt like progress as well, because not only had I written something, but I tried to sell them. So it felt like I was getting closer psychologically and to being a professional writer, even though I was still failing. And then finally, when I was like 20, I started to sell some stories to magazines, and then I published my first book like a year later. But that wasn't like the end of my failed books. Like I I wrote a whole other failed collection of stories in between my first and second, and I sold a few of the stories, but there was like 20 that weren't good enough, and the book itself, of course, did not sell because I didn't have enough good stories. I wrote I wrote like 150 pages of a failed novel after my first novel, which did not sell. Yeah, so I've had a number of failed books.
That first novel, though, I think you were saying that it helped you develop your discipline as a writer so that you were no longer just writing when you felt like it. Was that the case?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. In order to be good at anything, you need to do it for many hours a day, I mean, no matter what it is. So, I keep a little clock on my desk and I hit start at the moment I start to write. And if I ever stop, I stop the clock. And then when it's time to go back, I hit start again and I just try to make sure to hit a certain number of hours each day. And I've been doing that since I was 17.
I mean, you seem like an incredibly disciplined guy. I mean, like, you're not on social media. In fact, I remember back in the fall, Zach and I saw you walking around on set with a flip phone.
Yeah.
What's the story behind that?
Yeah, it's just to make sure that I have as few distractions as possible. I mean, as an adult, you're always going to have distractions. You're always going to have jury duty, and you're always going to, have to move, at some point into it. You're always going to have to, do your taxes. All this stuff comes up, your time to write becomes increasingly precious and rare as you get older. So you just have to police it and make sure that you use it wisely. Because it doesn't take that many hours to be a good writer. I mean, it's like if you write a page an hour, say, and you write 3 hours a day, which is very little. I mean, very few people work so little. 3 hours a day, that's nothing. That's still 20 pages a week, which is about 1,000 pages a year. 1,000 pages is a lot. So even if only a quarter of them aren't good, that's still a book a year. Still a good book a year, and that's a 3 hours a day. So if you can stomach, 6 hours a day, which is like more in line with like what a typical employed person does, then man, I mean, that's like Stephen King levels.
It's actually kind of funny that you mentioned this, because in Spoiled Brats, specifically in your novella Sellout, you are a character in the book.
An exaggerated version, yeah.
Simon Rich in that story seems to be pretty distracted by worldly pleasures and even just the idea of being a writer.
Yeah, that's a story. For people listening who don't know it, that's the premise is that my great-great-grandfather, Herschel Rich, who is a real guy, in the story he falls into, he works at a pickle factory, and he falls into a vat of pickles, and he's brined. And he comes out 100 years later and he meets me, his great-great-grandson. And he's just, horrified by the frivolous life that I lead as a Hollywood script doctor. So obviously for comedic effect, I make myself pretty reprehensible to give the story a good, a good villain. I actually work a little bit harder than that guy. But I do think that writing is a pretty frivolous profession.
You do a very good job, actually. I mean, of course, I know how much that means coming from me, in my esteemed opinion. I was actually shocked by the end of the novella by how, I don't want to give it away for people listening, but it was not an obvious conclusion of, oh, here's the main theme that he's been going for since page one.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, that's thrilling. Thanks, man. Yeah, it's exciting when a story, my favorite stories tend to be a little unpredictable, and they tend to hopefully have endings that surprise you. So that's a big compliment. So thank you.
Now, we've only got a bit of time left, but one of the things we want to touch on, because we haven't seen it done too much anywhere else, is your actual process. I know you were saying that you start the clock and you stop it when you stop writing, but what are some of the actual tools that you've developed over time? Like, I read somewhere that one of the tools you've used is to take an idea and flip it. What exactly do you mean by that?
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Well, I think, I don't think this is unique to me. I can think of a number of writers who I assume come at their premises similarly, like Ray Bradbury or, T.C. Boyle or, Stephen King. These are just a few of my heroes. I'm sure that they all have been doing versions of this trick for decades. But I think one of the tricks I use, or gimmicks, if you're being less charitable, is I just take a very simple story, something that's, hopefully emotionally resonant, something that's visceral, but not necessarily unique. And then I just try to come at it from a different perspective, a different point of view. So that could mean that, you know, it's literally told from an unusual character's point of view. Yeah, the story of my day-to-day life as a Hollywood writer told by my, you know, it's not very interesting, but when told by my immigrant great-great-grandfather, it suddenly does become a little interesting. Sometimes by a different point of view, it really just means I'll use a different genre to help contextualize the emotion. It's a little bit abstract, but, you know, for example, there's a story in my book, The Last Girlfriend on Earth, about a guy who's so in love with his girlfriend that he's oblivious to the fact that she's flagrantly cheating on him. Even though everyone else is aware, and it's a very, very sad story. But in the story, I make the cuckolded guy Sherlock Holmes, and he's trying to solve the mystery of, you know, where his girlfriend spends every Tuesday and Thursday night, and it's obvious to Watson, even Watson, who's extremely dumb, even Watson knows what's up, and Holmes doesn't, and you know he's usually a very smart guy, but in this case, he can't quite do the math because of this emotional block and, you know, the pain of it all. So it's, you know, my motto, and it sort of, it definitely extends to how we do things in my writer's rooms. It's my goal is always to try to tell old stories in a new way. That's really the goal.
Even though that story, I know, was only a few pages long, I felt like a friendship between Holmes and Watson that sure has been, you know, in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's books and all that. But I still, like, again, I almost like put down the book and just went like, ow, like that, you know, it's funny. It's a funny concept, but you still found the emotional truth at the center of it.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to give Holmes a little bit of redemption at the end of that story. So I just thought, well, you know, hey, at least he has something. And it ends with, well, giving up, I'm trying to explain to Holmes what's obviously happening. And instead, you know, being the supportive friend and just, you know, going along with it for Holmes's sake. But it's, you know, sometimes when you're writing a story, you don't really know how it will end. You know, I often don't. Sometimes I do, but I'm often surprised by how the stories I start end. They tend to take turns that I don't always see coming. I also change the endings a lot. I'll write a few different versions of a story. Like this morning, I completely rewrote the ending of one of my stories. So, you know, I'm always just trying things out, seeing what feels the most honest and what's the most interesting.
You know, you've obviously had an incredibly successful career, and you don't have to answer this, but have there been any regrets or missed opportunities?
Oh, interesting. Most of my regrets are projects I agreed to reasons other than I thought that they would be good. So yeah, I definitely regret wasting time every year. There's a couple, one or two things that I wish. Oh man, I shouldn't have spent a month on this or that. I should have known that wouldn't work.
What's the best piece of advice anybody's ever given you?
Good question. I would say, you know, man, I don't know. It's so hard to, you know, never really listen to it. Little things I believe I was told by some old person when I was young, but I didn't really believe it until I actually lived through it.
On the flip side of that, is there any conventional wisdom or advice that you think is wrong or overrated?
Conventional wisdom that I think is wrong. That's a really, really good question. A lot of times people tell you to write what you know. I think that that's true, but people take it too literally. I think it's important to write what you feel emotionally. I think write what you feel is great advice, but I think that if everybody wrote what they knew, then you know you wouldn't get any books or movies set in, you know, rocket ships or hell. So I think people shouldn't be hemmed in by their life experience, but I think you do need to write about things that are emotionally authentic and truthful to yourself. Otherwise, people will smell it and they'll know it's inauthentic and fake. But in terms of like where it's set and like what the characters do for a living, I mean, go nuts.
I guess one big last question being, at your most successful point right now, seems like you're, you know, you're happy. I think you've got a kid on the way. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah.
So you're, you know, you've got all these new things coming into your life, and you've said before that you can only really write about, you know, like what's really important to you at the time. What do you see consuming your thoughts and your writing in the next maybe decade?
I mean, I assume it'll be less about growing up and more about the adult world, about family and about having children and all of the emotional highs and lows that go into all of that. You know, I think that the good thing about being a writer is you never have to worry about running out of material. You just take all of the, you know, major visceral life experiences that are thrown at you and you just feed it through that little writer mill in your head. And so, yeah, I feel excited to see what the books are. We'll see.
What's next for you? I know that obviously you're working as a showrunner on Man Seeking Woman. Are you planning on getting into directing, or are you going to stick with writing?
I don't have any plans to direct anything. I think that to be a great director, you need to have a really strong visual stylist. That's something that I just don't have. I was never somebody who drew pictures growing up. When I'm writing, I don't see it in a very specific way. I don't think too much about things like camera angles. So I think writing and producing is just a better fit. I feel really fortunate to get to work with so many visually talented directors, people like, you know, Ryan Case or Jonathan Kreisel. I'm glad to have them holding up that end of the table, because I don't think it would be as good if I tried to do it all on my own.
Simon, we really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care, Simon.
All right, so long.